Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on Radio Free Palmer. We are fresh off of our Iditarod coverage. We did about 15 days of nightly coverage of the Iditarod, and I am thankful we've had a great following there, great bunch of listeners, great bunch of fans, and a heck of a lot of comments back and forth. So we're happy to be a part of that and happy to be done, thankfully. But tonight we're starting our first of many weekly shows on Radio Free Palmer every week, Wednesday evening, 7 p.m., right here in the Matsu Valley, radiofreepalmer.org, and the podcast will be uploaded there shortly after on mushingradio.com. Tonight we have an author on the show. His name is William Schneider, and he is calling in from Fairbanks, Alaska, and we're going to talk about his brand new book about the old school dog drivers that used to deliver mail in the interior of Alaska.
I'm good. Happy to talk about my book, On Time Delivery, the story of the dog team mail carriers.
You know, that's such a fascinating subject to me. You know, it's the precursor to a lot of the dog sledding races, including the Iditarod. I used to study quite a bit of mushing history, and I know that these guys used to deliver mail and whatnot during the day. Then on the weekends, they would get together and run some dog sledding races. So I think that's pretty cool in terms of how the sport got its roots, how it got started. But before we go into that, how did you become interested in this subject?
Well, I'm an anthropologist by training, and I did my early work out in a place called Beaver, Alaska, up on the Yukon, and I lived with an old-timer, Turok Newman, who used to freight out the road up to Chandler Lake, and he would tell stories about Keebuk Riley, who was the mail carrier for many, many years. And, of course, the classic story was that everyone waited for the mail carrier, and poor Keebuk had to break trail all the way up to Chandler Lake. At any rate, over the years, the story of the mail carriers was kind of a backdrop to all of the other events that got described in much more detail. And I think one of the interesting things about the mail carriers was that they really weren't dramatized. In the book The Cruelest Miles, you get a dramatic story. But in general, these were guys who, day after day, year after year, delivered the mail, and they were expected to do it, and they didn't really get much recognition. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe there's a chance to interview some people and to talk to some folks that remember the mail carriers or that grew up with them. And so that's what the focus of the book is about. And, you know, you talk about the Iditarod Trail, and we talk about the Yukon Quest Trail, and now we have the Percy DeWolf race that's about to start, if it hasn't already. And these really are traveling on these historic dog team mail carrier routes. And they, as you mentioned, pay recognition to the men who kept those trails open.
Exactly. And, you know, in this day and age, here about a century later, even today, so many people are so ecstatic when they open their post office, you know, their mailbox, or head over to the post office and pull out that letter. And, you know, it doesn't happen as much as it used to with email and all this instant stuff we have with Facebook and Twitter and all that. Letters are becoming a thing of the past. But also, even then, the mail delivery was becoming a thing of the past because of airplanes. I know you mentioned in your your cover there, you know, in the 30s and 40s, these guys were pretty much put out of work because of airplanes. So it's a little bit different age now, but, you know, it was happening back then too.
Yeah, there's several really interesting stories about that. One of them is that at the time of the gold rush, you had this influx of prospectors. And this was really a generation of people that were educated beyond what previous generations had been. And the letter, the personal letter, was incredibly important to them. And so they demanded the mail service and they demanded the federal government be involved. And the federal government got involved and created this network of trails. And I talked just about the interior ones, but they're on the coast and throughout. And that network of trails was incredibly expensive to maintain. It certainly didn't pay for itself in terms of the letters. And yet here today, you know, we face this issue of rural delivery of mail. And when you think back that here at the turn of the century, they instigated this tremendously expensive program, and they did it very successfully and rather quickly, too. And the other aspect to that whole story is that that network of trails remained important quite late, from, let's say, the turn of the century to the 1940s. So you had the advent of airplanes in the 1920s, maybe a little earlier, but you didn't have reliable airplanes that could carry the mail on a standard basis. You didn't have the navigation or the airfields. And so dog teams remained very, very important and significant for a long, long time, 40 years.
So even today, you know, in recent history, the Postal Service has been closing down a lot of these rural post offices in the interior of Alaska, and a lot of the roadhouses, even along the Iditarod Trail, were part of this rural mail network. I know Squintna and Yetna Station and those sorts of ones on the early part of the Iditarod Trail down here where we're at were very instrumental in the beginning of the Iditarod in terms of mail delivery and things like that. But my first question to you, Bill, is when a letter was brought to these guys that were delivering them by dog sled, my first question is how much did it cost back then? And second, how long did it take to take a letter from, say, Fairbanks to, I don't know, McGrath or somewhere down the network?
Yeah, I can't tell you how much it cost, but I can tell you something about the network. If a letter was mailed, let's say in New York someplace, before 1924, it would have traveled by rail across the country, by steamboat up, and then once it reached Alaska, it would have been carried by dog team. After 1924, with the building of the Alaska Railroad, mail that went to McGrath was routed through Nenana, and it would come up on the train from Seward, and from Nenana, it would travel west with stops at places like Tulida and Nikolai and that area, and out to McGrath, and then further west. So there was a transition when the coming of the Alaska Railroad, and it changed the routing of the mail.
Do you know how long it would take for a letter to say from Chicago, New York, the East Coast of the United States to get to possibly McGrath or even Nenana before it got on the dog sleds?
I don't know how long it would take along the major transportation until it entered the dog team era. But once it got on the dog team, say in Nenana, it might be a week or so before it got to McGrath.
Right.
But there's a really interesting story in the book that I kind of cribbed from Dan O'Neill's book, Land Gone Lonesome, which is something your readers might enjoy, too. It's about the Yukon Charlie area, Eagle Circle. Anyway, Dan did an experiment. He sent a postcard from Dawson to Eagle, and he said, now I want you to let me know when you get it. And he figured out how long it took for that postcard to go. And it went from Dawson down to, I think, Vancouver and Seattle, and then back up to Anchorage, and finally made its way to Eagle. Well, Percy DeWolf, who was the mail carrier, would have done that run in 4 days.
Hmm.
So, you know, there was an economy at that point in time. The most direct route was, of course, the dog team route.
Right, right. We're talking to William Schneider. He is the author of a brand-new book called On Time Delivery, the Dog Team Mail Carriers, a very interesting look at our history, not only as a nation and covering the mail, but also how it was delivered in the interior of Alaska and in northern Canada. So as we know, Bill, a lot of folks know the story of the Serum Run, which ended up was a precursor to the Iditarod, and how a lot of those guys leapfrogged or crossed the interior of Alaska, and some of these guys were mail carriers, and they did the relay, carrying that serum from Nenana to Nome. Were a lot of these guys also involved in that relay and carrying it, the mail and other packages and gear from one place to another? Or was it pretty much just a straight route as we have today with our mail carriers, you know, a formal route that they cover every day?
Well, there's a couple things about that story that we should maybe talk about first as kind of background. The book, The Coolest Miles, is something that will be of interest to your listeners because it's the story of the delivery of the serum, and it's really a well-written book. It's a great book. But one of the themes in that book is this whole tension between should it be delivered by airplanes or should it be delivered by dogs, because at that point, airplanes were just beginning to make their presence. And, of course, the decision was made that dogs would be more reliable and that they couldn't risk airplanes, even though airplanes, you know, might have been able to do it faster. And as you know, it was tremendously cold at that period, and so dog teams were the best way to go. And that brings up just another theme about this whole thing, is that dogs proved to be the most resilient. In the early years, you had roadhouses, and on some of the major arteries like the Valdez to Fairbanks Trail, you had horses. Because you had roadhouses that would support horses, would have water and warm barns and hay. But as the traffic decreased, as the gold rush declined and the population settled out, dogs proved to be the best and most economic way to go, because you could feed dry fish to dogs on the trail, and then when you got to your home cabin, you could cook dog food and prepare more for them. So dogs proved to be more resilient even than horses on many of the most remote of trails.
And you brought up a good point about the airplane versus the dog sled, even in 1925. And if I'm not mistaken, they did that route in terms of the serum run in about 100 hours, which is a little over 3 days, which is a pretty good clip if you're traveling 975-odd miles across, you know, some of the most remote conditions in North America. I can imagine that in the early days of air travel, that would be a very difficult route. But these guys were seasoned veterans. They've been doing it for years.
Yeah, that's correct. And they also had some support system along the way in terms of the roadhouses you mentioned. In terms of the telegraph, they knew when and where the mushers were. And it was an event that was followed internationally because of that communication.
Right.
And so it's really startling to me to think that it became such a huge story, in part because the world could watch it or could listen to it evolve.
Right, and that was one of the defining moments for the state of Alaska, well before it was even a state. That's where a lot of folks first learned about Alaska, was that story way back in 1925 or so. I'm sure, you know, listening to it on the radio and the newspapers and that sort of thing. It's just so interesting to talk about, you know, our history of America and talk about how things were so different than they are today. You know, and my kids, they get upset if their cell phone isn't working or the internet's too slow at the house. So I can imagine what it's like for these guys to be sitting around waiting for a letter from loved ones in Seattle or San Francisco or wherever, and it's going to take a week or more to get to them. But then sitting back, once that letter gets there and they sit around the campfire or the or the kitchen table and read that letter to the kids and the grandkids and whatnot. So if we can, Bill, and before we do, we're talking to William Schneider, the author of On Time Delivery, The Dog Team Mail Carriers from the Early Part of the 20th Century. Do you have a story about a particular carrier that that you can share with us and talk about maybe a little bit about his life, how he got involved with this, and, you know, what it was like to be one of these guys that did this day in and day out?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about Curly Wells, but remind me to also talk about this whole wilderness concept because it fits into how we look at the land today.
Sounds good.
But Curly Wells was the mail carrier between Circle and Fort Yukon, and the story is told, and some of the old-timers still remember this, that he had a loose leader named Rooster. And about 10 miles outside of Fort Yukon when he was coming in, Rooster would take off and run to the post office, and everyone would know that Curly Wells was on his way in. And another story that's told about Curly Wells by his son, Jimmy, who's still living in Fort Yukon today, is that Jimmy was one of the few kids that had got fresh apples at Christmas time because his dad, the mail carrier, could get them and bring them in his mail sack, you know, wrapped up to stay from freezing.
Right, right. Can you tell us a little bit of the history of how these guys drove their teams, how many dogs they used, how big their sled was possibly, you know, a little bit of logistics that are involved in terms of the dogs?
Yeah, these were not the racing dogs that you see today. These were big, slower dogs, heavier dogs, big, strong dogs, a 10-dog team, a 9-dog team. Would have been suitable to carry these loads. Maintaining that meant that you had to have, of course, more dogs than that in case the dog got hurt or dogs needed to be rested. And one of the themes that I talk about in the book is the support system. The family that you had that fed the dogs that you left behind, the wife or children that sewed the booties, that helped you with the fishing, cut the fish, dried the fish, baled them, and helped you get supply the cabins where you would be traveling during the winter time. So there was a whole support system, and of course the roadhouse keepers that where you were able to stay in a roadhouse. There was a whole support system that supported the dog team mail carriers. And when the airplanes came, that evaporated. And that kind of leads me into this discussion of wilderness, if I could take a second on that.
Sure.
You know, we think of the Iditarod and we think of the Quest and these big races as traveling through wilderness, and they are traveling through wilderness. But, you know, the interesting reality is that they're traveling through more wilderness than existed at the time of the dog team mail carriers. Because the trail system and its supporting members, including the roadhouses and all, that was the way people traveled. They traveled through the country. They traveled on the country. They knew the country. Today people travel point to point by air. And very few people are traveling in the country and through the country. And so this whole winter knowledge of the country is something that is not as well developed as it was back in, say, the 20s and 30s. And
right.
I think that's really, in a sense, it's too bad, but it's one of the realities of the modern era.
You know, that's exactly right. I remember even when I was a kid, one of the most important things in our family was that summer road trip. And we always drove. We never flew. Of course, we never took the train. But we stopped and saw the country. And that was such an important part of my childhood. And you're right. We're missing a lot of that today. And, of course, we're missing it from you know, the early turn of the century. If I can, Bill, I know there's lots of stories out there about these guys and being sort of the ladies' men of the early 20th century along these trails. And, you know, they had relationships along the trail and had lots of kids and whatnot. Do you know anything about that? Can you share a story about the ladies' men of the mail carriers?
You know, I don't, and I never came across that, although... You know, you kind of wonder about it because you hear stories about long-distance truck drivers and railroad men, but I didn't come across that. And people, I guess, just didn't share that with me, and it may be in part because I was interviewing family members, and that's not something they would want to talk about. I don't know.
Well, I had to ask that question. I didn't know if you had covered that in your book, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
No.
But tell us about what these guys shared with the folks that you've talked to now. You know, it's over 100 years ago almost that a lot of this went on. And I'm sure, like a lot of families, a lot of these guys are passing on now. What are some of the stories that the folks you spoke with told? What are some of their fondest memories of, you know, their grandfather, their great-grandfather, and how they did this as a job?
Well, you know, you're right. What we're talking about is the children of the mail carriers, for the most part. The only mail carrier that I had an interview with was Harold Woods, who ran the mail in the later years out of Rampart. And his sister, Sally Hudson, told a wonderful story about going to a dance in Manly. And she asked her mom if she could go, and her mom said, well, yeah. And they went with a bunch of other girls, and Harold and his brother took them because they were the mail carriers, and made their way along the trail, stopping at cabins along the way. And so they got to Manly, and Manly, they had a big dance with the miners there, and the miners gave them some money to buy stuff at the store. And that's how she remembered the trail. And Harold, of course, remembered the trail as times of the year when the mail would be particularly heavy, like at Christmas time, and when they'd had those big Sears and Roebuck catalogs or Montgomery Ward catalogs. You know, we think of the stuff we get in our mailbox today, but think of those heavy catalogs or people shipping in stuff for holiday time.
Right, right. And Bill, we have just a few minutes, about 5 minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit about how this influenced the Iditarod. Of course, we're a mushing show, and a lot of mushing fans, of course, love the Iditarod. And as you may know, they are still carrying the mail on the Iditarod. Each musher receives a packet of letters, of commemorative letters that are postmarked in Anchorage, and then they carry them all along the Iditarod Trail, and then, of course, they're postmarked in Nome when they finish, and that is a very important part of the Iditarod race today. Do you know when the last group of mail carriers delivered mail on a regular basis in the interior of Alaska or even Canada?
Jesse Evans was probably the last, or maybe Charlie Biederman. Jesse Evans running the Rampart to Manly run, Biederman running the Eagle to Circle run. Percy DeWolf was another real late 1940s mail carrier. Those are some of the last. Although out on St. Lawrence Island, there was a mail carrier that was even later. But that was the end of the era.
And that was the late 40s, you said, that probably?
Late 40s for most of them. But there was one mail carrier out on St. Lawrence Island, and I'm scratching to find his... it's Chester Nungawuk. The last dog team mail carrier, Chester Nungawuk, drove his dog between Savunga and Gamble on St. Lawrence Island in January of 1963.
Wow. Wow, so that's not too long ago in terms of history.
2 years. It's 2 years after President Kennedy unveiled his plan for a manned lunar landing, and 6 years before Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon.
Well, that's pretty cool. If we can spend just a couple more minutes, you talked about at the beginning of the show, Bill, about these guys being not only a very educated bunch, but a very hardy bunch. Who were these guys that came up? Were they all natives of Alaska, you know, Alaska natives, Canadian natives, or were they pretty much just these adventurer type, these explorer types that made their way up here and started to work a position like this?
Well, the earliest mail carriers were some of these white men. The earliest government mail carriers were both native and white men. And one of the interesting parts of this story is the native involvement in it, so that you had both native dog team mail carriers and you had intermarriage between white men and native women, and then that man might be a mail carrier, and then his son, a man of mixed heritage, would take over, or his sons, as was the case with Andrew Cochrane out of Panama. And so what's interesting to me from an anthropological standpoint is that these native and half-native dog team mail carriers seem to have been treated with a great deal of respect at the roadhouses and do not appear to have been discriminated against, even though we know that citizenship for Alaska Natives comes rather late in our history, and that discrimination was a sad part of the history of this country.
Right.
So
right.
This may be one of those things, like riverboat pilots, that cross-cut ethnic lines in terms of respect. And it may be because of what it took to do it.
Interesting. Bill, we're about out of time here. I want to make sure that we let folks know how to buy the book. It is called On Time Delivery, The Dog Team Mail Carriers. You can purchase it on Amazon, and we'll make sure we have a link over on mushingradio.com. And, Bill, before we run out of time, I want to thank you. It was only a 30-minute show, but I think you got some new fans to go out and check this book out. Relatively new, 2012 press out of Alaska Press. Bill, it was my pleasure to have you on. I'm thankful so much for you being a part of Mushing Radio.
Thanks. It was fun, and I encourage people to check it out, as well as some of the other books I've mentioned tonight.
And you can check that out by searching Alaska, University of Alaska Press. All sorts of books are available right there. So that's William Schneider, the author of On Time, The Mail Carriers of Alaska, by Dog Team, I guess. So it's been my pleasure. We hope to talk again soon, okay?
All right. Thank you. Have a good night, guys.
Thank you very much. So this is Robert Forto, the host of Mushing Radio. Check us out on Facebook at Dog Works Radio, as well as our podcast is available shortly after this show on mushingradio.com. We'll see you guys next week. We hope to have on Musher Zoya Denure. Talk to you later. Goodbye.